Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 4th of October 2015. My name is TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Phil from the West End Whingers, Johnny Fox and Paul in London. Just a quick note, we recorded this review before it was announced that Mr. Foot's Other Leg would be going into the Theatre Royal Haymarket. We're now going to talk about Mr. Foot's Other Leg by Ian Kelly. This is directed by Richard Eyre at the Hampstead Theatre, although given the cast, you can't help thinking they're lining it up for something else. It stars Simon Russell Beale as Samuel Foot, with Joseph Milson as David Garrick, Dervla Kerwin as Peg Woffington, and they are joined by Mika Balfour, Sophie Bleasdale, Joshua Elliott, Jenny Galloway, Forbes Masson, and Colin Stinton. This play deals with the life of a Georgian theatrical character who ran what is now the Theatre Royal Haymarket, although it wasn't called that when he ran it, and put on, well, comedies where he could dress up as a woman. Why not? Phil, another transvestite play for you.
Yeah, I've had a whole string of them. I've had four in a row where we've had men dressed up as women. But, you know, what's better than seeing Simon Russell Beale dressed up as a woman? I had high hopes for this because I'd read Ian Kelly's biography on which he's based his play. And it's a great read. It's a big, thick, weighty tome of a book. And it was interesting to see how he would condense it and make it into a play and what format he would put it in. I think he's made a good decision of largely setting it backstage. I think, you know, Simon Russell Beale, when I heard that he was going to be playing about, I thought that's the casting you would want for it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was an absolute riot. It's very, very funny, and it's very, very funny from the opening scene where Mika Balfour and Jenny Galloway are trying to sort of alleviate the leg from a museum of body parts which are in glass jars behind them. And it's a very funny, very crude scene with lots of cop gags. And it sort of sets the tone for the evening, which is largely quite broad, but it also actually becomes quite poignant, particularly in the second act when, after Samuel Foote, who had his leg amputated, not on stage as it's done here, but Ian Kelly's necessarily taken liberties with the actual story to sort of tell it in a backstage story. And there's great playing throughout. I thought Dervla Kerwin's Peg Woffington was rather fantastic. She's very, very likeable in the role and has a very, very moving scene in Act Two. Joseph Nilsson's Brummy Garrick was a riot, and Simon Russell Beale was just at his comedic best. I mean, he's eye-rolling, he's giving it large, and it's everything you would want. I mean, he's playing a larger-than-life actor, and what better than a sort of a larger-than-life actor to play that? I saw a very early preview, and I really wouldn't have known that it was... I didn't realise it was only the second preview that I saw. I mean, there were a few little things that needed tinkering with at that point, but the gags are funny, the staging is very lavish, the costumes are fantastic, the way the sets transform was very pleasing. It really has got the look of transfer written all over it with the names attached to this. There's some sort of interesting interscenes with Benjamin Franklin, who's talking about sort of the workings of the brain and the electricity of the brain, which I wasn't too sure about at first, but then it sort of worked. And actually, when Benjamin Franklin, who was sort of around at that time and in London, which a lot of people probably wouldn't know, I didn't until I read the book, he does produce for me what was the best sight gag, and the best sight gag I've seen in a long time, which just made us laugh out loud. I mean, it's 2 hours, 40 minutes, and it didn't feel like it. It's quite rare for me something that length to come out wanting more, and I did come out wanting more. It's just a riot. It's just a really, really very enjoyable evening, and I'd love to see it transfer, because this is the kind of show that I like. And I think the whole backstage thing, if you want to see sort of pomposities and arguments of actors backstage and also the things of the day which were going on, I mean, Ian Kelly plays Prince Regent, latterly the King, it gives them the royal warrant for the Haymarket, which was, I think, the little Haymarket Theatre, which I think it was next door where the actual Haymarket, the Theatre Royal Haymarket that we know now. It would be great if it transferred there, although I don't think that would be the best theatre for it, but it would be quite funny, I think, to see it go to the Haymarket. I'd like to see it again, which is the highest praise I can give something.
Quick, slight correction.
Right.
Ian Kelly plays Prince George the Third. He's actually becomes King George the Third. He's the one who goes mad. He's not Prince Regent.
I'm sorry. That's Prince Regent. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. History nerd alert. Okay.
Yeah.
Gareth, what did you think about this?
Well, I had a very different starting point to Phil because I hadn't read the book, and frankly, I knew nothing about the character, which is astonishing that I shouldn't know anything about Samuel Foote, given how fascinating he clearly was as a person and how well connected he was with the two famous actors of the day and the King and Samuel Johnson and Benjamin Franklin, all in his kind of network. So I was just amazed that, you know, finding this story of this fascinating man that I absolutely knew nothing about. And we mentioned his acting as a woman, but also what's very clever about him is that he got round all the stringent restrictions of the day because he invented work with no script, so there was nothing to be approved. And then he did it as tea performances and charged for the tea rather than the entertainment. So he could do whatever he liked without any censorship at all. So he kind of invented improv, I think, is amongst the most famous things he did. And as Phil said, it's uproariously funny. But it does get darker as the play goes on. And I think that's a good thing, because I think that gives the play much more depth. But, you know, but it is funny for a very long period of time and hugely enjoyable for that reason. And beautifully acted. I mean, Simon Russell Beale, we've known, has got great comic timing. But he's also got this uncanny ability to act without saying anything and to bring the house down with a raise of an eyebrow or a nod or a grin or whatever. And he uses that here to its full extent. I mean, the last time I saw him doing that really effectively was in Much Ado About Nothing, where he just brought the entire Olivier to its, well, not to its feet, but had the entire Olivier laughing out loud over just kind of his eyes, the way he used his eyes. And of course, he showed us that he can do women brilliantly with his Carmen Miranda turn in Privates on Parade. And here he is doing another terrific role dressed as a woman as well. So I just thought it was a fascinating, you know, it's a fascinating play, fascinating period. Very well written, I think, by Ian Kelly. And just beautifully performed. The way Tim Hackley's designed it is, he's kind of made it very intimate, because even though the set has to sort of cover backstage and a bit of front stage and sort of other places, I think he's done it intentionally small to give it a kind of intimacy, but also to give it a sort of, make it very faithful to the period, really. So I really liked the way, you know, you felt very much part of it, because even though the Hampstead stage is comparatively small, it can be much bigger than it was here, depending on how you design it. So I just thought it was lovely. We mentioned Micah Balfour, who plays his Blackamoor servant, as he was called, who I thought was hugely impressive. And Jenny Galloway, for me, was a delight as his other help, Mrs. Garner. So it's a great play about 18th century folk. This is a great play about 18th century theatre folk. And I think it's just unthinkable that it won't transfer, frankly. I do think it would be particularly wonderful if it were to go to the Theatre Royal Haymarket, because actually it's 250 years next year that he took over the Theatre Royal Haymarket. So I just think that's an anniversary that would be just wrong to miss, really. But I too want to see it again. There's so much in it, and there's so much to relish in it. I can't wait. I'll be going back.
I'd also recommend you read the book, because there's so much more in the book. It's enjoyable in a completely different way. And also, Samuel Book's sort of backstory. I mean, he had an uncle who murdered another of his uncles, and it was all, I think I'm right in saying, it was all revealed in a pamphlet that Samuel Foote himself wrote about it, and one of them went to the gallows. And that's sort of only referred to because there's so much to pack in, which I think was the absolutely right way to handle it. He was first of many things. I'd never heard of him until I heard about the book, and I thought, oh, I really fancy that. I mean, the fact his name is Foote is sort of classic, because there are lots of leg gags and amputation gags, and there's a very, very grisly scene just before the interval where we actually have the amputation on stage. So you do go off to the bar feeling slightly queasy, and then we have Simon Russell deal with a prosthetic for the second act, sort of limping around the stage. And I know we shouldn't laugh at those things, but it sort of makes it acceptable because Samuel Foote makes the gags himself about his own legs. So there's so much in it. There's so many things I want to see again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a great time at this. I mean, surprisingly, because I'm such a history nerd and like things to be accurate, I was actually quite happy. I was carried along very well, even though there were inaccuracies in this play. I mean, the thing about Peg Woffington, some of the other bits and pieces, although he does get the bulk of his history correct, I think. It's just some incidents. There are people who wouldn't have been around, but it didn't seem to matter a lot of the time. I really enjoyed this, just as you, people have said, it's a romp. It's having a lot of fun, and it seems to be using a lot of the ideas and the sort of the sketches that Samuel Foote wrote, and he does seem to be somebody we should have known more about. David Garrick, of course, came, I think, Lichfield. In the play Laughing Matter by my nemesis April De Angelis, which was done in 2002, and that was about David Garrick, featured Jason Watkins, David Garrick, and Monica Dolan as Peg Woffington. I mean, that really dealt with his background and his life, and it was very interesting. But of course, Samuel Foote wasn't anywhere there. It's enormously enjoyable, and one thing, again, an inaccuracy that didn't matter, Frank Barber, the character, was the name of Samuel Johnson's servant and the man who inherited everything from Samuel Johnson. I mean, he was the chief beneficiary of Samuel Johnson's will, but he was of course Samuel Johnson's servant and would only have known Samuel Foote. He wouldn't have been his servant or anything like that, or his dresser. But it didn't seem to matter. I mean, this worked very well together, and it's obviously been very clearly worked out. I think it helps that you have the playwright who wrote the book, but is also able to play with his biography, with his history, and knows how to bend it for comic effect and for a good story. I mean, it's a much better story of the way that Samuel Foote loses his leg in this than the reality, but it's just worked it together so well that you don't mind, even if you know it's wrong, you don't seem to mind at all, which is a tribute to it, really.
Well, the detail in the book is obviously meticulously researched, and I think he's done the right thing with playing around with the history slightly in this. I didn't know the history of it at all, but the huge passages about things that I knew nothing about in that period in the book, which is absolutely fascinating.
I think it's interesting that, and I think a great tribute to Ian Kelly, really, that he's achieved so much from his own starting point, because it's sometimes, the writer of a book is so precious about it that they don't make such a good adaptation of it because there's things they won't let go. And then to be in it as well, and then be playing very much a second fiddle to this towering performance by Simon Russell Beale, and he's clearly, handed it over to Richard Eyre, which I think is a great achievement, to take your work and trust others to create something so wonderful from it, really. So well done him.
We're now going to talk about Future Conditional, which is a play by Tamsin Oglesby and is directed by Matthew Waucus. It's at the Old Vic, where Matthew Waucus is the artistic director. This is a play about, education, and it really deals with the state of education in three different ways. We see a teacher teaching, he's played by Rob Brydon. We see a group of mothers and the occasional father outside a school, either dropping off or collecting their children, their primary school children, but reaching that age when they're going to have to find a secondary school to go to. And then we have a group of civil servants in a think tank trying to work out how best to structure education in the future. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, my expectations have been a bit lowered by the sort of okay but not great reviews, and they were significantly exceeded by the end product. There are, as you say, three strands, and they're all about our education system, and in my view about our broken education system. So the one that takes place with the the parents outside the school is looking at this ridiculous system that parents have to go through to find the right school for their child at 14. And it encourages lying, it encourages people to move homes and second homes and go to private education even if they don't want to. So it sort of exposes all of the issues around that by following these parents outside the school talking about their experience for their little Johnny, as it were. Then you've got this sort of second theme where you've got these educational policy people who are showing their own prejudices of their own background. So perhaps a bit predictably, we've got the sort of people from Eton and Oxbridge, and we've got the people from more humble backgrounds who are debating the issues of education, just kind of proving how policymakers have made such a mess, really. And then this third strand is really interesting because it has Rob Brydon teaching. And most of the kids are disinterested. He gets into a little bit of a trouble with the parents by the way he treats one of the children, but it's just, you know, parents thinking their kids perfect stuff. And then he has a child called Alia, who's a refugee from Pakistan, who's soaking up and absorbing everything. And she's very much a Malala character. And there's a sort of contrast between her experience of education here and the kids' disinterest that's quite striking. But what's interesting about that particular strand is that he's talking to largely, well, characters who are either invisible or mute. So he's kind of talking to kids who are not, they're sort of, you know, he's kind of inventing them before your eyes. Even though there are kids around him, there are actually actors playing kids around him, they're mute, and sometimes he's talking direct to kids as if they were in the audience. And I think his experience of stand-up probably helps him with that, because he does it in a way I described as Joyce Grenville-like, where he's kind of creating the characters through these speeches, and I thought it was extremely effective. I thought it was a bit slow to start, and I, for a while I was kind of thinking, yeah, maybe, I don't know whether I'm going to enjoy this that much. But at some point in the first half, it started kind of drawing me in. And then I just really got into the debate, the kind of really, I think, very intelligent debate about what's going on in education, but also in the entertainment of it as well, because it was also, you know, very entertaining. So I think it's very clever to be a fascinating debate, but an entertaining piece. And by the end of it, I was really gripped by the whole thing and very moved. I have to say, I'm very moved by it. And some might say it's too sentimental, but I actually just genuinely found this character, Alia, who's beautifully played by Nikki Patel in a stage debut. I just genuinely, you know, had such empathy with her as a character, and indeed thought the performance was great too. But also with Mr. Crane, the teacher, both with the character and, you know, and very sympathetic to the character's plights. And indeed thinking Rob Brydon, you know, his performance was excellent as well. So I really enjoyed it very much. I thought it, you know, it worked completely for me, very simply staged. The old Vic's still in the round. But it's just a platform. There are a couple of rock guitarists up on the boxes, the sort of the dress circle level boxes at the side of the stage, and playing sort of very kind of anthemic rock guitar pieces, which all work very well between the scenes. But other than that, you know, they just bring on a few props and perform it there in a way that works, because it lets the writing, you know, come through, and it lets the performances come through. Too many performances to talk about, lots of lovely performances, lots of extras who are not speaking performances, something like 20 or 25 people in this cast in total. And I just think it's great because somehow it does feel like a kind of a new period for the old Vic. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this before. We don't have any plays about education, or any plays about education, come to think of it. But certainly it felt very fresh in the old Vic, which has also had a little bit of a makeover front of the house as well. So I really kind of felt, going in and then doing the play, that this was the beginning of a really interesting new period. And even though some of the programming hasn't excited me, I just kind of, I sort of began to think this is really going to be a very interesting phase now for this theatre. So I would thoroughly recommend it. I would thoroughly recommend it. I think it's well worth catching for many reasons.
I saw it quite early and I enjoyed it quite a lot, but even then, I think what I tweeted afterwards was that it was very effective and affecting at telling its story and the story it was trying to tell, especially of the Alia character, and indeed Mr. Crane. And I was impressed by that there is this stoicism, and you know, there is no comedy really in Rob Brydon's performance, but it's none the worse for that. It is a very strong performance, his. But for all the way it involved people and people related to it emotionally, I could see that the cynics would tear it apart, and it was because you could be cynical about this play, and I think I detected that in some of the worst reviews for this plays, for this play. They attacked it because it is using one or two easy targets. I mean, there are people who are perhaps drawn along defined political lines, shall we say. So, you know, Lucy Briggs Owen is this sort of Scottish but very yuppie kind of mother, against Natalie Claymore, who is a very, well, possibly, you know, a socialist who has a choice of sending their child to the Sync Comprehensive or maybe taking up an offer to a private school that they can actually afford, because although she's from the working class, perhaps she's a little bit more middle class than that. But I could see that, you know, people could knock apart these battle lines, these well-drawn battle lines, this message that they've got against the sort of the upper public schools and this Oxbridge idea, and the idea that if you go to Eton, you're almost guaranteed to get into Oxbridge. It's not just a few people out of it. But this idea of the battle lines clearly defined, which anyone who wanted to be cynical could just batter apart, and you lose the message, which when you're actually watching the play, and if you're going there with a fairly open mind, you're going to be affected by it, and you're going to enjoy it, and you're going to be left worrying about the education system, and worrying about, you know, how we train our children. I don't quite agree with you about not doing educational plays. I can't remember what it was called, but the very good play upstairs at the Royal Court last year, and I think it was either the Royal Court or the Finborough, did a play called Little Battalions, again, about the structure of education. I think was a favourite of quite a lot of people, the play set upstairs at the Royal Court, where we're in a sort of an infant school classroom, and there was a certain insurrection against the teacher. So
I hated it so much, I've obviously wiped it from my mind. it was a dreadful play, and it did nothing for the debate about education.
Fair enough. But there were, I mean, there have been people attempting it, and I think this is a fairly good attempt. But nobody seems to have the answer, although there is an answer put forward here, but it's only, you know, only really for university entrance and not for much else, I think. It's not about, I mean, the major thing is with education, perhaps, that you've got to deal with the Sync Comprehensive and not worry quite so much about the people who make all the noise about trying to avoid the Sync Comprehensive. You've just got to try to make the Sync Comprehensive better. And they never deal with that, because they deal with the people who are making all the noise, and the people making all the noise want to send their kids to the nice schools. And the people who don't care about their children's education are prepared to put them in the Sync schools. And actually, it's the Sync schools you need to do. Anyway, that's me being political.
I think it is very partisan. You know, clearly, you know, she has points to make. But the fundamental points, in my opinion, are quite difficult to disagree with, because the things that parents have to go through for their 11-year-old children, you know, does encourage them to do ridiculous things like move home and buy second property and lie. I mean, it encourages this dreadful deviousness and bad behavior, just because, quite rightly, they want to do the best for their children. And the system encourages them to do all sorts of things to achieve that are not really that ethical. I think the second point that comes over quite loud and clear is, you know, would parents and administrators please let teachers get on with their job and stop interfering quite so much in education? And I think these are frankly difficult to argue with, and I'm not someone who has children who's ever had to make those decisions, but I think it makes those points really well, and I think it really does kind of say, look, this isn't working, we've got to do something about this. So I think it does have a strong message. It's a message that is partisan, but it's a message I find very difficult to disagree with, frankly.
We're now going to talk about Pure Imagination, The Songs of Leslie Bricusse. This is being done at the St. James's Theatre and is being presented to us by Daniel Taranto. So she's spread her wings slightly from the Southwark Playhouse. It has a cast which includes Julie Atherton, Siobhan McCarthy, Niall Sheehy, Giles Torreira and Dave Willetts. John, tell me more about the show and what you thought of it.
I have to say I gritted my teeth at the invitation to go because I was thinking, oh God, yet another compilation show. And I am pretty resistant to them. I haven't yet been to the new one about the work of Burt Bacharach, but that is supposed to be quite good. And then I started scratching my head and thinking, well, apart from Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd, and Stop the World I Want to Get Off, which he wrote with Anthony Newley, just what did Leslie Bricusse turn out that would warrant a complete show? And I think I must be in the same camp as a lot of audience goers, because you don't necessarily think of him as the owner of a canon of work in the same way you might think about Sondheim or, you know, anybody else who's more or less his contemporary. And it is quite extraordinary when you get there and you see there are 51 songs in the song list. And whether you read the programme or whether you sit through the show, you will just be constantly blown away by, oh my God, I never knew he wrote that. Oh my God, I never knew he wrote that. And, you know, three Bond themes, multiple musicals, a lot of really strong takeaway standards that you would have heard sung by Matt Monro, Shirley Bassey, Tom Jones. Name any singer from the sort of 70s and 80s, and they would have been doing Leslie Bricusse's material. Although it's not necessarily his music. If there is a fault in this show, it's that it plays up the music, and a lot of the melodies are really, really beautiful. But they're actually probably written by Henry Mancini or John Williams. And Bricusse was, I'll call him a whore, but in his career he has been the most willing collaborator. And it more or less didn't matter what anybody wanted. If they wanted the book, music and lyrics for a West End show, he could turn it out. If they just wanted the lyrics for a movie song, he was available. If something wasn't going very well and it needed a bit of a tweak, he was not too proud to take that kind of work. And I think that he's to be applauded for the fact that he managed to fit into the most extraordinary teams, both in his native West End, but equally in Hollywood, where he was in very much demand. And I think in this show, the most beautiful single melody is Can You Read My Mind, the romantic song sung by Lois Lane in the movie Superman. And I think it's actually Maureen McGovern who sings the song over the movie. And here it's delivered by Julie Atherton. And I have to say that the reason I did go to this show was for Julie Atherton. I've known her work from recordings only for quite some time, and I really wanted an opportunity to see her live, and this was great. She is unarguably one of the very, very best interpreters of musical theatre that we have, and I find it little short of astonishing, really, that her talents have escaped the attention of Lloyd Webber or Cameron McIntosh or any impresario of a serious size West End show. And it annoys me, really, that they continue to give roles to lucky novices from television contests rather than to really, really capable professionals like Atherton. She is a treasure, and she ought to be showcased in something even bigger and better than this. She has plenty of excellent moments in this, but it's not a conventional book musical, and I think that's probably where her strength lies. So what it is it's the soundtrack of the 70s and 80s and you know, a little bit beyond that. And I think the reason that Leslie Bricusse's musicals aren't so frequently performed is attributable to the pretty shonky book that attaches to most of them, because even though he could write music and lyrics, he wasn't really a great narrator. the original musicals, certainly the good old bad old days, which I think is the only one I remember seeing when it first came out, wasn't really a story. It was more a review. And like a lot of what he wrote, it was a showcase for his writing partner, who also performed, Anthony Newley. And the problem with Newley is that apart from the fact he had a really grating personality, which you either loved or hated, and a lot of people didn't take to, he had the most extraordinary vowels. I mean, he could get five diphthongs into a single syllable. And really, really, if you listen to him rendering, and that's a very well chosen word, something, I think it limited the potential for longer runs and better audiences for some of the work, because he was so very specifically someone you liked or didn't like. Anyhow, here, of course, we don't have any of Anthony Newley's vowels. We have a tremendous cast. We have Siobhan McCarthy, fresh from the tooting pie shop Sweeney Todd, rediscovering a jazz voice, and in the very brassy, I feel good, feeling good. I'm not quite sure what the song is.
Feeling good.
It's called Feeling Good, is it? Which comes from The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd, which is a 1964 musical. You will have heard that done by jazz groovers from Sammy Davis Jr. on down. Everybody does it. And it's the climax of this show. And for people whose tastes are not specifically musical theatre, it's really brilliant. And she does it fantastically, and she really enjoys it. A couple of other people that I should mention, maybe Paul will talk about some of them, but I want to name Giles Torreira, who is undoubtedly among an excellent company, the man of the match for me. He plays a rather curious role that the characters are the man, the woman, the boy, the girl, and then a fifth character played by Torreira called the Joker. There's a little bit of discomfort about that, because he's a black actor, and Leslie Bricusse did write a character in one of his musicals called The Negro, which possibly is one of the reasons it can't be performed nowadays, because that would be culturally insensitive. And Torreira plays an outsider figure, and he's kind of miming and doing sort of strange gestures and introducing things. So he's a little bit like the narrator or the mute in The Fantastics. It's that sort of, you know, a little bit creepy like the clowns sort of character. But, you know, he triumphs over it tremendously, and everything he does really shows a spellbinding vocal technique. It doesn't matter that they've made him do this mimetic choreography and given him a shabby costume and a silly hat. His natural musical talent just shines through. Bricusse has already said that he's writing a new musical about Sammy Davis Jr. called Sammy. But that can't be right, because the musical Sammy was premiered in 2009 at the Old Globe Theatre in San Diego. So I think possibly he's reviving it. And he's said that he definitely has Giles Torreira in mind for the role. And in my humble opinion, if he doesn't get it, there is absolutely no justice. Talking of the choreography, I said it was a bit mimetic. They've really scaled it back. And where it happens, it punctuates the songs quite nicely, but it doesn't overwhelm. And so for me, I mean, that makes it 1,000 times better than the last compilation show I saw at St. James's, which was that dreadful overproduced You Won't Succeed on Broadway If You Don't Have Any Jews. All the arrangements and the musical direction are by Michael England, who has worked pretty tirelessly to homogenise the songs. They are very disparate, and he's given them a cohesiveness. Whether he's also given them a slight feeling of repetitiveness in the orchestrations, you could say that, particularly in the first half, that there is a little bit of sameness coming out of the band. But this is a very, very good band, and it sounds like a band that has been playing and rehearsing together for quite a long time, which is very refreshing for some of these kinds of shows where you think people just came together and picked up the dots 3 days earlier. So there's a lot of really good stuff, and I think it's well worth going to see. I think it's on for another 3 weeks, or certainly from the date of recording. So do take your chance and pitch in and see it. I think Paul's got something to say.
Okay, I think this is one of the better compilation shows I've seen lately, and I think part of it is the strength of the material, but also the quality of the production, and also the quality of the musicianship here. John didn't mention the band, but it's a terrific-sounding band under the direction of Michael England, who also did the arrangements, orchestrations, and is the music director. I think there's some terrific harmonies happening here, particularly when the music stops and all the singers actually just singing a cappella together. It is
quite exquisite. And I think this is one of the shows that has quite a lot of surprises with it. There's a wonderful James Bond medley, starting with Goldfinger, then going through to Thunderballs, Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and You Only Live Twice, all of which Brickus collaborated with John Barry on the music to create. And rather than actually going for the traditional arrangement that we're familiar with, particularly with Goldfinger, it was much more of a deconstructed jazz sound and playing up the comedy elements of it, which was hilarious, actually. I would have actually preferred to have seen a few more different arrangements, actually, because that gives the potential to see the music in a new light. But, you know, given what we got, I think it was a terrific collection of music from not just, the 60s and 70s, but 80s and 90s, and even more recently, such as the work that some of his unproduced musicals, including the one Sammy, which did have a run in 2009, and which it seems to be getting much more interest in having a London run soon. I think one of the highlights of the piece was the closing of the first act, where they decide to do a London medley of songs, starting with London is London, through to My Old Man's a Dustman, and which I think is a favourite song of mine, and I had no idea that Brickus actually co-wrote that with Lonnie Donegan, and it was a hit, I believe, in the 60s. And it's led to a rather rapturous response in the audience, and I think having quite a few celebrities singing along to My Old Man's a Dustman, he wears a dustman's hat, he wears cord blimey trousers, and he lives in a council flat, I think is a particular memorable highlight from seeing it on press night. But there's such a range of the stuff that he does. I think I also would have to agree with John that Giles Torrera was absolutely terrific in this role of the Joker. There is actually a song called The Joker, which I was familiar from the TV show Kath and Kim, but it comes from the role of the grease paint, the smell of the crowd show, which is also where the song Feeling Good comes from, which closed the show. And I think Giles manages to give the right balance to the songs and give it also a comic approach that really works well in this piece. He also, is dishing out candy when singing The Candyman. And I think on Tuesday night when it was press night, he was prioritizing throwing candy at the critics. I think he was trying to curry favor rather than injure them, but it was a lot of fun, and I think he definitely should be on the West End much more. Siobhan McCartney also has some wonderful songs to sing in this piece. I think you've got a good performer coming out when she's just merely sings the first few bars of the song Feeling Good, which closes this compilation piece, and the audience is almost begging her for more, and it's catcalling and so forth in a very provocative way, but I guess it was a very provocative performance on her part. So I think it's quite a surprise, this little compilation show. Definitely one of the better things we've seen lately, and definitely worth seeing to see the extensive work of a British composer who is still alive and still writing, and you'll be surprised to actually recognize, I think, so many of the songs in this piece, and that realizing that you know them and didn't realize that he was part of it.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azzetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.